Okay, great, it started. And now we have 19 participants. So I think hopefully most people who wanted to join already have. And anyway, since we have the recording, in the interest of time, let's maybe make a start to this. So I'm just going to share some brief introductory slides to this endeavor. So finally that we're all here, welcome to Duo Exclusive and Tagging Validation Group. So of course, you've already had the emails from us, you know who the conveners are. Please contact us, either, well, any of us with anything relating to the working group activities. So maybe it's good to start with the charge to our working group for the proposal. And this is something that has come from the overall steering committee. We're on a very tight timescale. And essentially the first task that we need to do is to identify the key physics observables that are described in the yellow report and that pertain to our working group. So this is the kind of the idea there is that we need to update our yellow report plots using the actual detectors of the Athena proposal, including the full kind of setup, the inactive materials, et cetera. Of course, this is something that will only be available later in simulations, but we need to identify what to focus on early on. We'll need Monte Carlo samples, we'll need event generators with their control cards. We'll need to decide with the software working group how we pass this information to them, where how to distribute this to users so that people can use this generated data in the simulations with different types of detectors. Something we need to make sure right from the start is that our OMC samples have all the proper and consistent setup for their crossing angles for IP6, for example, and the full setup for the interaction point setup for the IP6 point. So the next point in the charge is that we need to identify only two or three plots that will really illustrate the ability of Athena to address the physics that was laid out in the NAS report and in the yellow report. So we will only have a very few pages in the full proposal. So there is only space to focus on really a couple of benchmark processes and focus on a couple of plots that really illustrate this. And ideally, we need to identify these things to focus on very early on in the stage so that we can test the impact of different technology choices and inform the collaboration about how well the different technologies perform to help identify the ideal technology. And the final point is that, of course, want this to be competitive, and we need to look for maybe some additional physics performance plots, something else that will give Athena a competitive edge, a competitive advantage to this proposal. So can we take this to the level of actually quantifying the systematic uncertainties, showing that finding the optimal solution to minimize this? So we need to, the charge of our group really is to support and work together with the detector and software working groups very closely. So as I mentioned, we're on a very tight timeline. So we're already at the very end of May. This is the stage of preliminary setup and tests. May and June, by the end of June, we need to have identified our benchmark channels. So end of June is also when the charter should be complete. This is the formation of the executive board. July is the development of the detector systems, the selection of the different technologies, and the implementation of the sort of final designs of these technologies for the overall Athena detector. August is the stage of the full design test, and then really September, October, this is the time when we run with the final, with the full simulations and finalize our plots for the proposal. The final draft in November is the time for finalizing the draft, and then early December or 1st of December, it has to be ready. So this is an extremely tight timeline. It's much tighter than the yellow report ended up being in the end. So the takeaway message is that time is very short. We need to start straight away. Our first deadline is to identify these benchmark channels by the end of June or preferably earlier. So we have only a number of weeks to do this. And The first steps is really to produce sufficient generated data with the full Athena interaction point parameters that can then be in the output format that can be fed into different simulations, as full simulation as possible. But of course, this is not going to be finalized until there is a full design of the technologies. But we can already commence the simulations with available detectors. And so, so this is kind of, this is the introduction. This is the kind of charge to us. And so the point of this kind of kickoff meeting is to identify to already have a discussion about which benchmark channels to focus on, to identify what people can work on, where they can contribute, what kind of tools they already have at hand, and sort of lay out, discuss, and identify a kind of plan forward for the coming weeks. And so maybe before we launch into a proper discussion of this, we thought it would be really nice to look at some of the lessons that we could learn from the LHC and from the HERA era. And Paul has very kindly agreed to say a few words about this. So I think rather than going into discussion now, I would like to pass on to Paul. If he's there, yes.
There will be time for discussion afterwards.
Yes. Maybe also in the context of Paul's presentation.
Okay, you see some slides?
Yes.
Okay. Okay then, friends. So, well, the convener's asked me to say something about what happened at HERA, which was a long time ago. I haven't had too much time to prepare this, so I haven't yet included anything about the LHC, although it's certainly from the more technical point of view, it would be useful to think about that as well. So the scope of what I'm going to talk about today, and it's only sort of a short 5-10 minute presentation, similarities and differences about between EIC and HERA. It's not necessarily the right place to start, but there are some useful things to consider about it. Then I wanted, at least from the point of view of collider physics at HERA, start maybe some discussion on some input for what would be those most important observables that we're asked to look at. And along the way, I'll make a few comments from a sort of more experimental point of view. Wouldn't quite say lessons, but comments. So starting with similarities and differences, I mean, I think we shouldn't overstate this. I mean, what HERA was a high energy electron proton collider. Well, there haven't been any others of those. It also had a strong emphasis on exclusives and tagging forward protons, which wasn't there to start with actually, but by the end it was a crucial part of the program. And it also had polarized lepton beams. But there's a lot of things that the EIC has got that HERA didn't have. One is ions, so it was never an electron-ion collider, despite people's attempts. Never had polarized targets. And I think that second point makes a huge difference, actually, to the exclusive and diffractive program. So, you know, it's not something I'm going to cover. And then the other thing that makes a huge difference is luminosity. So HERA was roughly three orders of magnitude lower in luminosity than was foreseen for the EIC. It was order 10 to the 31. So that was just some sort of disclaimer to start with, really, to say that it is useful to compare maybe and to see what we can learn, but it's certainly not necessary to follow what happened 20 years ago in a different continent. One other quick disclaimer is that I worked on H1, so pretty much everything that I show here is from H1. If I were given a talk for Zeus, it would probably be similar. Of course, there was also a very important fixed target experiment here at Hermes, but that would be a different talk entirely, and maybe not one that I'm qualified for. So a couple of things about the detector before I launch in. It was reasonably hermetic. I think the biggest gap was for scattered electrons, and there's sort of two orders of magnitude between the beamline proton tagger at 10 to the minus 2 and the main detector at Q squared of 1, where there was no proton tagging. Otherwise, by the end, there was an attempt to sort of have coverage everywhere, I think. Elka's got a hand up. I don't mind being interrupted if you're waiting. Or do you want to wait for later?
No, yeah, what I wanted to quickly ask is, I guess you didn't want to say that HERA was a machine which
really had tagging integrated in the machine design, because it didn't. Your acceptance of the forward going Roman parts and so on was pretty okay.
Yeah, okay. So I think I come to that in a minute, but yeah, quite okay. Right. I think that's a definite limitation, which is certainly a lesson we can learn, but I think we got that bit right already. Okay, so there's a slide here, which is just sort of an overview. So the central mass energy, 300 GeV. I've already mentioned the low luminosity. So, you know, by the time it had run for 15 years, it was half an inverse femtobarn for experiment, whereas we think about inverse atobarns at EIC, don't we? But from the physics point of view, I just tried to count here for H1 the number of papers that were dependent on exclusive or forward proton tagging in the end, and it's huge. So there were 15 on basically inclusive cross-sections in diffractive DIS, diffractive final states, another 18, vector meson production, DVCS and so on, 22. And then I've also included total photo production cross-section because dividing that down into diffractive and non-diffractive components was an issue. So you've got what, 40, 55, over 60 papers just from one collaboration based on diffractive channels, essentially, which is probably about a third of the overall output, maybe a bit more. So it's really fundamental in the end to the program. There were basically two different methods that we used for selection. And I think this comes back to Elka's point a little bit. So I tried to distinguish left and right-hand side. The left-hand side is the sort of thing that EIC will hopefully be spending most of its time on. So this is tagging protons and neutrons, for that matter, down the beam pipe. So that's just a picture of where H1 at various different points had its proton taggers. The proton dissociation taggers were just there to try and find remnants to see if the proton had broken up or not. That was for cases where the proton wasn't tagged. But then there were proton taggers at 61, 80 and 220 and a neutron calorimeter as well. So proton tagging was one method of doing diffraction, but then the other one was looking for large rapidity gaps, and that's illustrated on the right-hand side. So if your proton goes off down the beam pipe, more or less undeviated, and there's a color singlet exchange, then there's a region of the detector which is basically empty. So the basic signature there was this eta max variable, that there was nothing forward of a certain eta in the detector. So the way the diffraction was done actually at HERA was a mixture of these two things in the end. I think it's fair to say that the large rapidity gap method was important because of exactly Elka's point, which is that proton taggers was a sort of retrofit to the HERA detector. It wasn't part of the initial thinking, and none of this beamline instrumentation went in until late. So that's you know, the fact that it wasn't really thought of as mainstream physics before the program started was one point. The other point was, of course, that there hadn't been many Roman pots built by that point. So compared with now, where you've got LHC experiments, Totem, I think, at some point had 15 different Roman pots operating. So it's a very different world now in terms of Roman beamline instrumentation technologies. So all of that leads me to the conclusion that I think EIC is a different world, which will hopefully be focused much more on the tagging side. But then I wanted to go back and say that I think it's also important that you have the correlation to the central detector for all sorts of reasons. One is understanding your beamline instrumentation. So you need to be able to align the detectors, you need to be able to calibrate their energy response and so on. So you need something to calibrate against. And so you need calibration channels, and those are things in the central detector. So in the HERA context, it was usually exclusive row production, where you basically calibrate the position and the energy measurements in the proton taggers with respect to that. And then the other thing is that pretty much any measurement you can think of, apart from an inclusive one, also relies on understanding some of the particles in the central detector as well. So it's not as if we can divorce ourselves from that. You know, it's not even as if we can divorce ourselves from the central detector apart from the scattered electron. There's a whole load of different stuff that needs to be understood, and that you need this system X as well as the proton. I just put this in to emphasize that Roman pots might not be quite as simple as they look on paper. That's a picture of the very forward proton spectrometer in H1. So that's 200 meters downstream, but you can see how much kit there is there squeezed in between the dipoles, and there's a bypass for the cryogenics and all sorts. So it is complicated. All right, so I just wanted to pick up on two key observables from collider physics at HERA. One is exclusive, and so that's exclusive vector meson production or exclusive photon production, deeply virtual Compton scattering. So it's the diagram in the top right there. And of course, this is going to be a very key observable in EIC physics as well. What was the physics discussion around? Well, the W and T dependencies. So basically thinking of this as a photon-proton collision was very common. So then W is the center of mass energy in the photon-proton system. So understanding the W, the center of mass energy, and the T dependencies and how they change with Q squared led to a whole story of the transition from soft to hard physics, and all of that was presented in the language of Regi phenomenology, alpha Pomerons and all sorts of things like that. So that's sort of illustrated in the bottom left-hand plot. So as you go up in photo production, where the photon has Q squared tending to zero, from soft vector mesons, rho's, omegas, and so on, the energy dependence steepens once you get to J size and so on. And that was also something which did get carried on in the LHC with ultra-peripheral collisions. There's a plot in the middle of this slide about the J psi, which has also got points on from LHCb, and there could be Alice points on there as well, and CMS, I think, too now. So that was one thing, but the other language of this is probably the more interesting one, which is looking at X and Q squared dependencies of this, understanding hard physics in terms of dipole models, but also in terms of different types of parton densities. So those J psi measurements that I've shown there were always interpreted in terms of the gluon density of the proton. More sophisticated than that, there's a whole program of generalized parton densities, which did exist in the HERA era, but maybe sort of came to the fore about halfway through. So I think the EIC physics is going to be much more focused on this this hard QCD physics, isn't it? One other sort of experimental type comment to this, you know, of course one wants to measure everything, but the things that were easiest to measure were two-prong decays of vector mesons that had high cross-sections, so rho to pi pi and J psi to leptons are the obvious two examples. In those cases, at least at HERA, we found that the kinematic measurements were best done from the tracks rather than from the protons. You got a more precise measurement by measuring T and W from the vector meson decays. Although, and a lot of this was done in this sort of quote large rapidity gap type method where the protons weren't tagged, but of course it would have helped a lot to have them tagged because we could have separated out proton dissociation background if we did. And then there's just two illustrations on the right hand side from H1. There's a very high W J psi event here where you see the muons going out in the electron direction, a low W event where they're going out in the outgoing proton direction, just designed to illustrate the point that there is a very strong correlation between the direction that your vector meson goes in, and hence your lepton, hence your decay products go in, and W. So if you want to maximize your kinematic range, central detector tracking over the widest possible kinematic range is crucial. Another experimental comment probably relates to two things. One is particle ID and the other is hermeticity, really. So this is just an illustration from rho electroproduction of where the backgrounds come from. So if you pick, okay, they change a lot with T, so you get a very clean rho to pi pi signal in the top left-hand plot, which is the lowest T bin. But if you come to some of the higher T bins here, you can see these background contributions, which are really quite large. So where do they come from? Well, two different sources. One is things like phis. So the lack of particle ID and the fact that we didn't really fully exploit, I don't think, even DE by the X and trackers, allowed a lot of phi background and so on to come in. But then missing particles is the other thing. So omega to pi 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 zero, rho prime to four prongs and so on. By the time you get to high T's and you've missed particles, so that gives you a typically large T, these become really quite quite pathological. So very important to have the hermeticity that we aim for in EIC as well. And then I didn't think I should leave DVCS alone because I think it's absolutely vital at EIC. It was covered at HERA, probably, well, two reasons why it wasn't more prominent. One is that the cross sections, of course, were a lot smaller. And the other is perhaps the kinematic ranges are not quite so interesting as they will be at EIC. Okay, so that was exclusives. Then the other big topic in HERA diffraction was inclusive. So it's the diagram in the top right-hand corner here. So this time your photon, if you consider it as a gamma P process, your photon is dissociating to a multi-particle system X, which has got any mass you like, MX. And it was usually discussed in terms of these variables, X Pomeron, which is the fraction of the proton's energy that gets exchanged, and beta, which is the fraction of that exchange momentum, which couples to the photon. So a beta Q squared dependence looks like an X Q squared dependence for the proton, but in the diffractive case. So, I mean, this is a leading twist process, unlike the vector meson cases. So I think that surprised a lot of people, the fact that 10% of the total cross-section in DIS remained diffractive up to really quite large Q squared values, as far as we could see. And it was discussed again in terms of the soft physics, which is basically the W and the T dependencies, usually wrapped up in terms of X Pomeron and T. So that nicely shows a factorization between soft physics at the proton vertex associated with whatever gets produced, and then hard physics of trying to understand the physics of what gets exchanged in terms of the beta Q squared dependence and diffractive parton densities. So there's a couple of illustrative plots here. I don't think this was ever, you know, really completely understood in the end. So the alpha Pomeron characterizes the energy dependence, and that doesn't seem to depend strongly on Q squared for this process, which leads you to the conclusion that it's soft at the proton vertex. And then the beta Q squared dependencies were all interpreted in terms of these quark and gluon densities explicitly for diffraction. So that led to a whole load of physics topics, which we'll come to in a minute. Just the remarks on from the experimental point of view once again. So this large rapidity gap method was limited in the end by understanding of how often the proton dissociated. And the way that was best tackled was actually from looking at the ratio of large rapidity gap to proton tagged measurements. And there's a nice plot here from Zeus, which just shows how that ratio, once you've understood it, is constant throughout the whole phase space. So that was how it was controlled. But then, you know, even from the point of view of kinematic reconstruction, because it's not so easy to calibrate the energy measurement of the scattered proton, measurements of the mass of this system X, the hadronic final state in the central detector, was absolutely key to the kinematic reconstruction throughout. So this was a typical reconstruction method, even used in the LPS case that's shown here. So beta was reconstructed using Q squared and MX, and then X Pomeron was reconstructed from X, for example, from the electron divided by beta. So even with proton tagging, it was useful to use the hadronic final state in the central detector. And then, of course, the next step, once you've measured the inclusive cross sections, was to ask some questions about this system X. What does it contain, and what's the physics of it? And I think that's probably the next slide. Yeah. So, you know, there's a whole load of papers which were on basically trying to characterize this system X that gets produced in inclusive scattering. And there's some work gone on in that in the EIC case already. The center of mass energies are not large enough probably to do any jet physics with this central system, but diffractive charm was a big topic, and it turned out that could be nicely described with diffractive parton densities. And there's all sorts of work with energy flows, charge particle spectra, and correlations. So I think important, the experimental comment really was that correlating your system X here with your proton is absolutely crucial, I think, to doing more than the most basic of physics. Right, so that was a whistle-stop tour of, I think, probably characterizing the main things from HERA. Things I didn't cover, stroke summary, all in one slide. So I think the first point at the top here, again, comes back to the point that, you know, incorporating proton tagging into the interaction region design and making sure you've got the maximum possible acceptance from the outset is crucial. And I think there's a tick for that, because there's no doubt that people are thinking those terms. I didn't talk much about alignment and calibration, but I did briefly mention it. So, you know, the row channel is the important one here. So it's essential to have some overlap or you end up in quite a mess. I think that's been even more tricky at times at the LHC, where calibration channels were a bit harder to come by. I didn't talk about XQ squared reconstruction, although I gave a similar talk in the inclusive group a moment ago about, you know, how best to reconstruct X and Q squared for diffractive processes. The answer is not necessarily just from the scattered electron alone. The fact that you've got the exclusive signature in the central detector means you can often do better by including the rest of the event, the vector meson of the photon or whatever it may be, in your XQ squared resolution as well. So that might be something to think about. I think it's fair to say that I covered the main topics from HERA, but I mean, leading neutrons was also a topic. I saw Bill was online, Bill Schmidtke. So that led us to understanding the pion structure, for example, and I know there's EIC physics around that as well. And of course, diffraction in EA is still a topic which is yet to be addressed in any sort of collider mode. So I haven't said anything about that, but I think obviously it's very important. Okay, that was all I had.
Great, thanks very much, Paul. That's really, really nice kind of coverage of that. And I think actually you have a really good reminder that it's so easy to be focused on the physics that interests you and sort of considering the ideal detector to reconstruct it, that you sort of forget that actually you're going to have to work with those detectors and calibrate them, and making that feasible is a very important part of the design of them. So any comments, questions to Paul first of all, before we go into the main discussion? I didn't see any hands. Okay. Oh, yeah.
Well, maybe just one thought. It's just stupid thought, but, you know, it's clear to me that, for example, we have a huge advantage over HERA on the design of the forward spectrometers, because they are fully integrated from the beginning and so on. But is there, and of course an EA, which is a full greenfield scenario, but is there any mistake that comes to the mind of Paul that we should, for instance, avoid in our detector, or anything that we should actually learn, like some lesson that should learn that, for instance, I don't know, H1 run into some problem doing this diffractive physics that we should particularly care not to repeat that mistake, or things like this, let's say?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question. So, I mean, one thing that comes immediately to mind is this issue of particle ID. And I think, you know, that could have been a lot better, shall we say, which would have helped us to do a much more complete and higher precision set of measurements of exclusive particle production. I suppose, you know, if you are going to have cases where you don't tag the leading proton explicitly, and this will be even more true in EA, it's important to have some sort of sensitive detector that can sort of cover the phase space and see if there's dissociation or nuclear breakup. So, you know, there were, it's amazing what you can do just by throwing a bit of scintillator around the beam pipe in the right sorts of places. Those were a couple of things. I'm sure others can think of more.
Yeah, thanks.
I think Spencer's got a comment as well, or a question.
Yeah, one question. I mean, one of the things we've talked about a bit on the AC is the question of resolution, and in particular, the contribution of the beam. You know, not all the beam particles are the same momentum or energy. I mean, was that significant at HERA, and how did you deal with it?
You mean because of initial state radiation?
No, because of the beam momentum spread. This is something Thomas Ulrich had pointed out, particularly for measuring T. You know, right. If you measure the outgoing electron, it's only, you also have to assume the momentum of the incoming electron.
Right. So that's why I mentioned initial state radiation. So there are some kinematic sort of reconstruction methods which use the hadrons instead, as well as the electron, which can sort of reduce your sensitivity to that. Because you're right. If the incoming electron radiates a photon, then, you know, your center of mass energy changes. So there are clever things you can do with XQ squared resolution for that. It's a long time ago, but I don't remember being sensitive to the spread in the beam energy. I mean, T was measured from the PT of decay products in vector meson processes. It was never possible to measure it at all without the Roman pots for inclusive scattering. But yeah, maybe that's something that's going to matter more for EIC. And I mean, crossing angles, the other difference.
Right.
Okay.
Thanks.
I think it really wasn't as big an issue at here. I don't think it was as big as at EIC because of the intense focusing.
Mm-hmm.
Can I make a comment to this?
Can I finish first?
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in fully reconstructed events, it was actually measured and observed when you measured the protons and the rho and everything. You could actually measure the beam divergence that way. So we were sensitive to it, but I don't know that it dominated. But go ahead, Elke. Thank you.
Yeah. If you want to have high LUMI, you need, of course, to focus hard. As such, your emittance of the beam becomes larger. So you have always a trade-off between some of the beam parameters and your luminosity. If you want to give in into the things, you reduce your luminosity. So that is the difference between Hera. Hera had only 10 to the 31 luminosity. Here we talk about 10 to the 33 and a lower square root S. And it is much harder at lower square root S to have high luminosities than at high square root S or higher beam energies, because you cannot pack the particles so dense in a bunch. And that is where that comes from.
That leads me to a question then. Is it possible, suppose this group decided they wanted to collect some data with a factor of 10 lower luminosity, but much less beam divergence, can EIC be operated in such a way?
Absolutely. We have already two operation modes, high density, high divergence, and high acceptance. And if you see the latest papers to IPAC, then you see that you can go down. And if you go down in the divergence, for example, by a factor of 2 or 3, you might lose a factor 5 or more luminosity. But yes, that is not driven by, that is an optics setting. And of course, the machine is tuned to some extent, so you cannot go to 10 to the 31, I think.
So it's a clear trade-off if there was something where the resolution could be done. Okay, that's good for this group to keep in mind. Yeah.
I think, Lodek, you've got a question or comment?
Yeah, just two. Clearly, maybe what Bill is talking about is that for the high cross-section processes, you can run at the lower luminosity, and as Elke explained it, it's done with just different optics. And there the beam divergence is limited. I just wanted to also, Paul said it twice, and I want to stress and second that this alignment and of the Roman pots is extremely important. At the Hadron Colliders like LHC or RIC, we have a constraint of elastic scattering to make those alignments, which is a very powerful constraint. And the PT balance, let's say, that is used or was used for the raw measurement at Hera is also good, but I'm not sure how good it is given the constraints that were mentioned in terms of the beam divergence and PT smearing and all these other things. So as Paul says here, and it, I think it's being done, but this has to be built into the thinking from the beginning. And one of the ways to do it is with something we haven't seen at any collider yet, to make sure that those Roman pods are surveyed and aligned with respect to the beam position monitors in the machine. Usually that step is missing, and it's very hard to go back and do it. So that's my practical comment on this alignment issue. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Can I make a comment to this as well?
Please.
You can do a beam-based alignment, actually something which we have done in HERA very often, where you change your fields of the magnets around, for example, the IR, or you can do that around the Roman pods. And that is actually a very good method to align things. And that's something which we can do. And of course, we can also, as you say, and point out, Flodek, we can use the beam position monitors. And we will have very high precision beam position monitors around the Roman pods.
Yeah, the offsets are most important. They have to be aligned with Roman pods. That's
exactly that's one.
Okay, and this beam-based alignment, I'm not sure I know about, so I have to educate myself. Because
we have never done that in RIC. So that's something which we did. We did regularly in HERA, actually.
Well, I know that there is this beam-based alignment, which determines very well the relative, all the relative variables that allow machine to operate optimally. But at RIC, this beam-based alignment was never translated into something that is outside of the beam. So all the relative changes are very, very well done, but to connect it to the outside system like Roman pods or anything is harder. So, but okay.
I was about to jump in and talk about Atlas, but I see Maciej is here and has his hands up, and he knows it much better than me. So.
I just wanted to comment that, we should assure that they are really BPMs all around the Roman pots and along the line, because it's never too little of BPMs to measure the beam. So this is the first comment. And yes, the beam-based alignment procedure is something we do at the LHC with some precision. However, it would be also good if it would be possible to design the pot in such a way that there is something like a quartz window, so one can really look maybe with the laser inside and see what is the actual position of the pod bottom. Because what we learned from LHC is that design differs very much from reality. In principle, there are a lot of pod rotations which were not supposed to happen, but they are there, and it's hard to correct for them.
Yeah, thank you. Elke?
Yeah, so Rom, I agree with you. Having a laser would be optimal, because then you can kind of have this and change your laser and reflect it back and measure the deviation like we do also in TPCs. So that is something which would be a good system. That is something we haven't yet thought about to integrate, but the BPMs is something absolutely. You need a lot of some around the Roman pots, no doubt about it. I agree completely with you.
Thank you. So I don't see any other comments. What I'm kind of gathering from this discussion is that this is a little bit out of the immediate application of kind of looking at specific benchmark channels, but this is very important sort of feedback to the detected design groups. So in a sense, I think it would be very good if all of these ideas could somehow be communicated back to the relevant detector groups, as opposed to far forward group regarding the Roman pods, BPMs, etc. I don't know if this is already happening in some way, but please do feed this through to the detector groups. I don't see
how can you separate your physics from your hardware?
Well, you cannot, but I'm worried
so
that...
Isn't that one thing which needs to go together more than we did in the yellow report for the collaboration?
I think so, but I'm worried that this discussion could get lost if we start focusing on very specific channels. For example, there are the focus on calibration channels that could get lost. So I'm just sort of trying to say that it would be good if somehow this doesn't come out naturally from the studies that we end up doing here. It's good to communicate this through to the detector people straight away from the beginning. And I'm not sure of the best channel to do that, apart from just encouraging people to, I suppose, communicate with those conveners.
Well, the far forward conveners are both here.
Oh, that's good. That's a good point. Yes, you are indeed. That's good. All right, so I wonder whether we should not sort of switch now to a discussion of the plan for the coming weeks. And at first we weren't sure how many people would connect, and we thought maybe it would be good to kind of do a very quick roundtable of people just saying what they have available to work on, what they would like to work on, what they think is a very important channel or should be one of the benchmark channels. And if they have any tools that are already available. I mean, in most of those cases, we have a lot left over from the yellow report study days, but it's quite a lot of us, so I'm not sure whether going around the whole table so it's going to be a the most kind of useful use of time. So maybe we'll just open the discussion table for what you think should be channels that we should focus on. Anybody to make comments if they like. I mean, I think from Paul's presentation and of course also from the yellow report studies, it's looking clear that we probably do need to include DVCS as one of the channels and probably a mesin production channel, vector mesin production channel, possibly. But we need to remember that we only have a few pages to fill. So we can only really focus on a few plots.
Would you say, I think we need to, when we choose channels, we need to be careful to choose ones that are sort of complementary and will test the detector in different ways. You know, it should be a global decision, not just a local one.
So I wonder if we have really to pick three candidates here. If instead of, okay, if perhaps to choose, I don't know, the vector mesons in EA and the problematic of suppressing the incoherent background, which is something that challenges the detector, and the DVCS plus pi zero background that also challenges kind of the idea of particles and see if one can suppress the background. These two, plus I think we should put something for diffraction that we have to think about, right? Which is not exclusive.
Is this covered by any other working group, by the way? Because if it's not, then it's
covered by us, I guess, yeah.
There's one very important thing that Paul said that I think we should echo and go into those traces about the relationship between rapidity, and I'm thinking here of vector mesons, but it's more generally true, rapidity and Bjorken X. And when, if you want to cover probe targets over the full range of Bjorken X, you need a detector with very wide acceptance and rapidity. And in fact, you know, for light mesons like the Rho and the Phi, we probably don't have the acceptance we really want. So I would argue pretty strongly that that should be one of the channels, either the Rho or the Phi.
So this goes over the how many channels we want in the first place, we have to decide. Yeah. Because certainly I couldn't focus exclusively on the exclusive, if you forgive me the tongue twist. So do we want something for the mesons and also for EP? Then we need something for the inclusive as well. And I don't know if you want to put something like some new things that appeared in the white paper that weren't done at HERA, or you know. Mm. For example, correlations or this kind of studies. I don't know if we want to do a mix of like main topics like and new things that are very interesting, but all of them should challenge the detector and the forward region to see if we can. And again, this is now an argument for our detector. It's not in the yellow report. It was just, you know, let's focus on this. But now if we fail in something, perhaps we don't want to advertise. I don't know how to say it. But we need actually to make a good case for our experiments without cheating, of course. But
well, I think if we identify something important we're failing in, then that needs to be, you know, then we need to work.
We need to leave it to be addressed now.
Fix it.
Right now. Yeah.
We should fully exercise the detector and know the weaknesses as well as the strengths.
Yeah. So I feel like in a sense, where we might have a cutting edge, the sort of 0.3 from the chart of where does it give us an advantage over other designs, I feel like that might not become apparent until, you know, a lot of different processes have probably been tested. So yeah. I'm not sure that that's something that we can decide at this stage. This is probably the kind of the final stages of the simulations.
Actually, do we have something on top of our mind that give us an advantage on the other designs? Because it doesn't come anything to my mind.
A bigger magnet, so probably better resolution, but...
I would say, I mean, for me, it's fairly hard to differentiate in terms of physics performance between the different detector designs. I guess resolution matters and minimum PT is also important, particularly if you want to do phi to K plus K minus. But, you know, I don't know of a whole lot of differences in the designs of the far forward detectors.
Which, since the conveners are here, actually, I would ask, do we have any difference between, I don't know, the far-forward detectors for ECHE and for this collaboration, or are they supposed to be a copy, let's say?
So that's a little bit of a loaded question. So in principle, both groups need to do their own simulations of whatever detector assumptions they have and say why their, you know, particular setup is better. In practice, there's just very few people available to do the simulation. So in practice, there's going to be a lot of cross-studying and optimization between the two groups. So for example, the convener for the ECHE Far Forward group is Michael Murray, who was one of our co-conveners during the Yellow Report. Him and his R&D group from the EIC R&D project are focused specifically on ZDCs, and primary ZDC expertise for the EIC is within their group. Our group contains the primary expertise for some of the silicon tracking, Roman pots, off-momentum detectors, because we have most of the people that are involved in the EIC R&D24 group for that exact purpose. So ultimately, much of the detector design and choices will probably be very similar between the two groups, and each group will just run their own simulations for validation. So you'll probably see a lot of the ECHE detector folks at our far forward meetings and vice versa, basically, is the takeaway.
And what about with core? Like, I think I remember they have more freedom to vary stuff because they really focus on this kind of physics. So they can compromise, for instance, choose crossing angles or whatever, even compromising. Compromising maybe is a strong word, but like limiting some of the other capabilities in favor of optimizing on this. This is at least what I got. I don't know if
core is focused on IP8. So I'm not sure that there's really an issue of deciding on technology for IP6 with a relationship to core. The IP8 design will by necessity be quite similar, of course, leveraging some of the potential benefits for the difference in the lattice design. So I don't think there's going to be a desire to reinvent the wheel, so to speak, and choose entirely different technologies if there's ideal technologies already employed for IP6. But there's not going to be a lot of, you know, reason necessarily for us to work super closely with the counterparts for core for the proposal purposes, because Athena is focused on purely IP6.
Yeah, that's my point. So I expect that there might be differences with core more than there will be with Etch and the proposal for the forward region.
So, Salvatore, where are you heading with these questions? Because I don't understand why we should worry about Etche and Core.
No worry. Yeah.
Why should we discuss it even?
Yeah. I think, problem.
And I just one comment. I agree that one needs to focus on few, you know, most important measurements, as Daria mentioned. I just would hope that at this point, with the yellow report and all other work that was done, I think that should be well established. Maybe someone, because I'm not familiar, I'm sorry, I didn't read all the documents, but my impression is that the work has been done. And now we just have to make sure that, you know, with the real detector that is being proposed and solutions that are being put forward, we can demonstrate that it all works.
Well, I think you're exactly right. But I think what we have to do now is condense from the yellow report the really kind of key benchmark channels, because we don't have the opportunity. We don't have the manpower, the time, or the space in the proposal.
Sure.
To discuss all of those channels. So I think it's true that at least in the yellow report, it's well separated sections. So we can look through the exclusive section and look at through all the processes. And it's true that there are some processes that are by themselves different. They look at different physics or complementary physics, but they have completely overlapping detector requirements. And so maybe we need to make sure that we kind of cover the full sort of space of detector requirements without kind of having overlap in processes. So so maybe that is something that sort of needs to happen. I mean, actually, and sort of listening to the discussion of the far forward, how important that is, I think actually we also need to look at a light ion channel. We need to make sure that we can detect and reconstruct the light ion recalls. That would be an aspect of the physics that is a challenge, and that would be, we need to validate that.
So I have a comment. Hi, this is Kong. So I think from my opinion that we're pretty much sure what all the processes are there, right, in the yellow report. We're not going to invent new processes or new physics for this paper, detector proposals. So I think a more practical question for me will be like reducing this matrix, right? Whether this matrix can be still reducible by combining different processes to answering probably very similar questions in order to fit into the page limits and also to give a very good presentations of what this proposal can do, right? I mean, there are many processes or benchmarks you call, but at the end of the day, the physics question might not be so different. Many things can be combined. I think the first thing I would look at is to compile a list of everything, but then trying to reduce them into a couple groups or a couple, you know, similar processes for similar questions that can be reducible. And so then in the proposal that we can start to have manpower to work on this very typical process. And many things can be just, you know, either stated or can be applied in a similar way instead of going through all this yellow report exercise again. So to me, I really think it's not like what processes there are. I think we all know what processes there are. It's about like how we can combine them and reduce them in a very concise form. And then we can only pick a few to do very similar or very detailed analysis in the far forward region, and then in that case, and I think to me that will be clear to be written in the proposal.
Yeah, I think that is a good point. So in a sense, maybe this is homework for us to come up to list all these processes and perhaps start with a grouping that we can discuss in the next meeting. But on the other hand, time is also quite short. So in a sense, if people already have, if we could identify or agree on certain processes that we're pretty sure will be looked at, then it would already be good to make a start on producing the generated data for it. It's possible that it's already available from the times of the yellow report. but we just need to check that the crossing angles are correct for IPsix, that the configurations are correct for that.
I would actually prefer if we regenerate what we are generating now, like really, really being sure of all the cards, all the parameters, everything, you know. That sometimes when you recycle generations of events done for a test or whatever in the yellow report, we might not be able to track back actually all the decisions in done in this generation, right? So I think it's always safer to regenerate again.
And I agree.
So. Yeah. No, that's true. And also there might have been updates in generators. I know that's at least true for the TCS. So I wonder whether we need to, whether we kind of just give ourselves homework to sort of start crystallizing this list, and also maybe ask, or whether we should already sort of in preparation for the next meeting, ask you to start looking at the generators that you have at hand. I don't know what the feeling is generally here.
Do we want first to agree on processes and then look for generators for those processes? I don't know.
Well, I think Kong made a good point that to sort of do this, I mean, it's kind of hard to just say, what do you think we should focus on? It's easier if we list indeed all the processes that we've done in the other report and then look for overlaps, look for ones, for example, JPSI and TCS, there is certainly overlap in terms of reconstruction there. So maybe we just need to focus on one of the two. Etc. So like this, we can reduce it.
JSI seems to me like the, in many ways, the easiest process. It's a real sweet spot for many things. And I would prefer to have slightly more challenging processes.
Yeah. But so when you say, for example, Kong, when you say like we condense, do you propose, for instance, like, I don't know, in the JPSI or TCS, to produce one plot for both or kind of stuff, I don't know, like that condenses the information in one figure, or how do we condense otherwise? Because
yeah, I think that's what I had in mind. I mean, of course, I don't have a concrete plan, but I think many processes we use different probes, let's say different vector mesons, or let's say in the light ions we use different light ions, deuterons or helium 3. I think many of this could be combined at least in a coherent way. We could, I don't know, we could design a plot to point out the similarity and the differences if we combine some processes. I think that way is one way to condense these discussions, because apparently we cannot pack everything in this tool. How many pages are there? Is two or three?
Two or three for us, because it's 60 in total, and that
includes- right exactly. So that is like very, very challenging, right? Like two pages. So I really think we need to have a very condensed versions. Maybe we have to sacrifice, or I mean drop some of this. Let's say we use some of these systems or vector mesons as a range, or like in terms of band, arrow bars or something to present, instead of going through the whole discussions on very similar but slightly different probes.
Yeah. Sylvester, you've got your hand up rather than just shouting.
Yeah, so I just wanted to make, you know, one remark. So, you know, you're of course correctly, you know, talking about the fact that the page limit is very limited. But in principle, if everything else was unlimited, you could in principle do all the processes and make that decision in November which one you want in. But one other thing to keep in mind is that just the processing capabilities are limited. So the amount of simulation, real simulation we can do is a limited resource. So while it might make sense to simulate slightly more processes, than in the end you will include, because, you know, for example, if you want to sell the strengths and the weaknesses of the detector isn't, you know, fully crystallized yet. So that's not necessarily something you know right now. So I think it's important to, you know, make sure there's a lot of bases covered and that you have a good idea of how many events you need for these channels. You know, if you need, you can have double the channels if you need half the amount of events, you know, from a computational point of view, at least. And, you know, make sure that all background contributions for the ones that we really include are, you know, at least studied to some degree, so that it's really a realistic simulation and you have realistic backgrounds to the processes as well. And you know you can, for example, pull out your TCS.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Actually, maybe you can shed some light on this, because it wasn't entirely clear to us whether how much of the simulating sort of gets done by us as a working group, or how much of this is just us giving their generated data. And then the final design is, you know, do we get to see the stages of using different technologies, using different detectors, what effect it has on our
process? Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, each of these full simulations are going to be, you know, they will have to be run by at least by a small amount of people, just so we can coordinate that no one really burns through all of our compute time. But yeah, of course, it's going to be a back and forth, because you'll be responsible to actually analyze these samples. It's just that, you know, we'll have to communicate with each other and see who will be the person to actually push the button on the simulation, which, you know, isn't in the end that important. Who is it, as long as everyone is talking together? Mm-hmm. But we'll need to make sure, you know, the full simulation data will probably be hosted at BNL. It will be kind of expensive to move around, so we'll need to run the analysis on top of that, maybe run it multiple times if we need to tune the analysis itself or tune digitization parameters. But then from the working group side, we need to have analysis codes in place that can give us relatively rapid feedback on what we're getting out of this.
Okay, that's good. Great. Spencer, thanks.
Yeah, so a question, you mentioned, you know, running it working. Does this mean that there will be central simulation resources and, you know, a central facility? And I guess if so, that would be RACF. And what sort of allocations do we expect? And can you give us a little bit of information on that?
Yeah, so I mean, we're still talking, with the computing people are still talking about how much storage we will have available, because that may be the, you know, depending on how efficient we are in running, that could be the thing that runs out first. So right now we have something of the order of half a petabyte that we can count on as the collaboration, which should be sufficient in my, you know, sort of my, if I do my quick back of the envelope estimation, but we need to keep that into account. From the computing side itself, yes, BNL is one of the sites. We can do, you know, simulations at JLab as well. We will use OSG. We will use other lab university resources. But there will be a central repository, at least, of the full simulation files and everything else at BNL. But we can disseminate the smaller reconstructed data files, or the things that you will actually want to analyze as a physics working group, to different sites, because there will be quite some data reduction going from this full simulation to the reconstructed files.
And does that mean there will be sort of, if there's realistic detector simulation, will there be realistic reconstruction tracking?
Yes. Yes, has to be.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
That's a pretty tall order, given the amount of time we have left.
Yes, and this needs to all be ready before July, essentially. Because, you know, we can't analyze full reconstruction data if there isn't full reconstruction data, and we have, if we just use BNL and JLab, we have something of the order of 3 million core hours per month, which is not that much. I'm confident we can do more in sort of a burst running mode, but most of it will have to be done in a slow burn, meaning we need to start early.
Mm-hmm.
At least the simulation itself, once we have something that looks like a reasonable detector or a couple of detector options, those simulated files shouldn't change. And that is the most expensive part of the entire process. The reconstruction is much cheaper.
And you think it's realistic to expect to have, obviously not final reconstructions, but ones that will have an efficiency that's representative of what you might expect for the actual detector and software that we hope to have in a decade?
It's realistic to have something good enough for the level of the proposal. I'm assuming that it will be better in a decade. It's not going to be perfect. Efficiencies, of course, you know, we have to be more resilient against a lot of different types of events in a real experiment versus what we're doing now with the you know, with the working group simulations where we're simulating specific processes. But yeah, it will be representative. It will be to the level that we can use it for the proposal, and more important, actually, to even to have something that is realistic enough for the TDR.
Mm-hmm. Alexander, you've got a comment.
Yeah, so do you expect that we cannot run the simulation and analysis on our own computer because it's too big, or is that a possibility?
You can run a little bit of simulation on your computer. I mean, it depends on how big your computer is, right? You know, but if you want a really large sample, you know, something that generates hundreds of terabytes, that's, yeah, if you want to store, you know, a petabyte of data locally, you can do that. Of course, your one channel might not be one petabyte. So, you know, it's, I don't think it's impossible, but we won't be able to host everything at JLab, for example, because JLab does not have the disk storage available to do this. You know, JLab's entire farm is only a couple of petabytes in storage, and that's mostly allocated to running experiments.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure if I'm going to run simulation for this group, but yeah, usually I try to run stuff on a small sample on my computer before I try to.
Yeah, that's absolutely, that's not a problem. I mean, it just depends on how many events you simulate.
Kong?
So I wonder if we can do it in a hybrid way. Instead of running every processes full simulations, I think one of the exercises that we did with me and Alex was trying to do a small samples of full simulations, right, including the IR, the magnets, the beam pipe, the divergence, the crossing, and everything. And then we can parameterize all of this acceptance and resolution effect. And then we, of course, we need some statistical significance distributions. But then for our larger samples that we use these tables that we generated based on the small full simulations and do the full analysis. So in that way, we don't have to pass through full detector simulation for a billion events, but then it's only like 10 million events for full simulations. And then we could reconstruct these tables that we can look up and do the full simulations in a hybrid way for the full analysis. I think this way we save a lot of computing time and a lot of the disk space. So I wonder if this could be a viable solution to everyone. Because at the end of the day, the technology will change. Their details will be changing, and this full simulation might not be accurate at all. So then if the numbers that we're presenting using this hybrid method will not be very different, then I think, at least to me, this is a much quicker and more reliable way. Instead of having everyone run full simulation, I don't even know how can everyone do that. And with the disk space, Alex can comment how much space that is. Just from our group, and you said that 0.5 petabytes for the entire detector proposal, but just from this group, we might be able to take all of them. So I think we really have, and also given the time limits here, that I think we really have to maybe think of another solutions or a compromise or hybrid solutions.
So I definitely think that's a really good point. And that's something to bring up, you know, at the collaboration-wide level, because this just needs to be, you know, this needs to be part of the entire integration strategy. You know, if we want to do full simulation, the amount of full simulation that we can realistically do is of the order of up to 250 million events for everyone, which is not a ton. It's definitely not billions of events. So if we need billions of events, you really need billions of you know, events. They can't be full simulation. That's, you know, we just don't have the resources for that.
And just right, just to give some hard numbers on some very simplistic simulations of the far forward region, meaning that just a couple of detectors, no beam pipe, and you know, certainly not the level of complexity that the central detector contains. A couple of million events already starts out at 125 gigabytes. And that's just for a few layers of silicon, some magnetic elements, and a few particles per event. So, you know, any kind of complicated channel that includes the main detector will very quickly balloon in the amount of data storage you need and the runtime that you need. And so I think the talking point that we've been kind of discussing for the past couple of weeks is that, you know, the simulation effort needs to be highly coordinated to make the most efficient use of the resources available, which I think the whole collaboration is aware of this at this point. And that's something that is going to be important for the working groups to decide on the channels they want and coordinate the effort of the simulations themselves in a centralized way. So in other words, it's probably not the best idea for people to go off and run their simulations on their own unless they're using their own resources to ensure that the coordinated effort is as efficient as possible.
I think that's a very good point. I think it's good, essentially, that clarifies the point of what we can do. And from the charge to our working group is to produce the generated events. And then this is outside. The full simulation is a centralized effort. So it's good to get that clarified. So I think we should probably start wrapping up a little bit because we started late also, but this is now going into more than an hour. So I wonder whether actually at this point we maybe need to have some kind of shared Google document or something like this to note down ideas for the benchmark channels or the channels that we would like to have a sort of short list for the benchmarks that we'd like to work on that people could also add to, add comments on. Because I think this would be a more kind of inclusive discussion. And the other point is, so maybe we can set this up for the next meeting. The other point is meeting times. So I think we're just going to have to circulate a doodle poll because presumably everybody has called in, is happy with this meeting time, but we don't have the people who couldn't make it. So there are a couple of hands still up. I'm not sure whether this is from past comments or whether this is new comments. Spencer, Kong, are you? Spencer, maybe. No.
I had one before. I don't know if we want to wrap up, but my comment was actually, I agree with you in the end. So you preceded me to say, like, we need to focus on what kind of simulations we want to pass to the detector groups rather than the full simulation optimization, which is maybe off our charge. But it's like, the amount of events that we want to pass them in the end is also correlated to what Alex was saying, that, you know, if we pass billions of events to them, well, forget about it, right? So what kind of actually, and this is really not clear to me yet, what kind of plots we want? So do we want, because one thing is that you need billions of events when you do an impact studies, a full analysis or stuff like this. You may need hundreds of, like, hundred thousands of events when you want to just show like a variable, or, you know, what kind of plots we want to show.
I think we need to show physics plots. I mean, this is a proposal, right? That we need to show plots that illustrate that we can achieve this physics from the white paper, yellow report, whatever, with this precision. So I think this is going to be, it needs to be higher level than just particle distribution.
Then it might require a billion of events, especially if you want to show cross sections in several beams and stuff like this.
Yeah, that's true.
So we really need, before we pass the simulation to these guys, we really need to decide, because otherwise we are not optimized. They will start running full simulations like crazy and we will run out of time. So we really need to focus on three plots we want to achieve and then pass them those billions of events to achieve those three figures. I don't know.
Well, I think you're right. I think there's no straightforward answer to this at this point. I would say, why don't we start with a Google Doc where we can note down channels that we think we can start it amongst the three of us what we feel we should include, open it to the whole working group. Then if people want to make strong points for a particular channel, then this can sort of form the basis of the discussion for the beginning of the next week's meeting then. Because hopefully then, you know, maybe we can convert already or identify certain channels and certain plots in next week's meeting. What do you think?
Okay, so please, everyone, come with like your favorite list or whatever and justification for it, and we can discuss it. I don't know.
Yeah.
And convert. Yeah.
Okay, we'll circulate a link for you to put on Google or on a spreadsheet or something.
that's good. Yeah, Google Doc, and we can do offline.
Yeah, we should spend some time thinking about what needs to go in all of the columns. What are the important things to consider?
I mean, what we would, I think, ideally want is some kind of, I don't know, Compton form factor plot, which includes contributions from JPSI production, from DVCS, from victimisms.
Yeah, but that goes so far away that you cannot see the direct impact of a detector in it. It's just extrapolation. It's really far away from data to show Compton form factors.
Exactly. Yeah. So you want some happy medium between actual physics, but a direct link to the detectors. Okay, yeah. I think this needs more thought. All right. So then, if nobody's got any final comments, anyone from conveners or from anyone else, then let's wrap up. Thank you for this first meeting. We'll circulate a doodle poll for future times.
One question is how often we want to meet. I mean, that's, you know, is every other week maybe for starting now or every week?
I think possibly we need maybe every week for the start. And then once we get going, maybe we can take it to every 2 weeks when people are really working on things. Because I think we need to, at the moment we're just building up momentum. We need to build up this momentum. And then I would say.
Fair enough.
Sal, you're muted. I could see you speaking, but...
Sorry, no, I would say like we can start every week until we meet this June deadline of sending the benchmarks, and then we can relax a little bit until September.
Yes. All right, so let's start with the weekly meeting, and then we can, if needed, we can skip weeks. We'll set a doodle poll. So thanks, everyone. And bye-bye. Enjoy the rest of your Monday.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.